Welcome back, everyone. I am Cass Piancy, and I'm here, as usual, with my partner in crime, Bennett Tomlin. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Cass. How are you?
I'm doing good. There has been a lot going on. I was briefly away out of town, so we couldn't record while all of this was happening, unfortunately, but it seems like it's time to talk about it now. So I want to play a clip of Deputy Attorney General Monaco speaking about what is, I guess, the largest seizure of funds ever in the Department of Justice's history. So here we go. I'm going to go ahead and play that.
The department has charged Ilya Lichtenstein and Heather Morgan for their alleged roles in a conspiracy to launder stolen cryptocurrency taken during the 2016 hack of a virtual currency exchange. That hack resulted in the theft of almost 120,000 Bitcoin. Today, the value of that Bitcoin has grown to over $4.5 billion. The Department of Justice has seized over $3.6 billion worth of that stolen cryptocurrency. This is the largest seizure of cryptocurrency ever by U.S. law enforcement. It is also the department's largest single financial seizure in its history. The prosecutors and investigators from the Justice Department, IRS Criminal Investigation, Homeland Security Investigations, and the FBI followed the stolen money on its complex journey through a labyrinth of virtual currency exchanges and wallets based here and abroad. As the defendants tried to launder funds through various virtual currency exchanges, many asked questions about where the money came from, or even froze funds based on their suspicions. The defendants are each charged with conspiring to commit money laundering, as well as conspiring to defraud the United States. This case is emblematic of the approach the department is taking to the growing threat of the illicit use of cryptocurrency.
And so there it is. What you know is what we know, and that is that these two individuals, Ilya Lichtenstein and Heather Rahan Morgan, were arrested, and they're being innocent until proven guilty, but it seems like they're responsible for trying to launder nearly $4.5 billion in Bitcoin, in stolen funds from Bitfinex. It's a lot of money. It's a crazy story, and let's get into it.
Where should we start with this story?
Yeah, why don't we've done an episode about the Bitfinex hack. So if you really want to get into the weeds about that, you should go back and listen to that. I don't know. Do you remember which episode that is?
It is episode one, right around the 20-minute mark where we discussed this Bitfinex hack.
So there you go. You can go ahead and try to give that a listen if you want. But let's go ahead and do a quick recap.
Sure. In 2015, Bitfinex's hot wallet was drained. A few months after that, Bitfinex settled with the CFTC for offering illegal contracts to U.S. persons. And then Bitfinex announced that they were going to do something revolutionary and be the first exchange to offer physically delivered futures for Bitcoin, allowing them to again be compliant with U.S. regulations. In order to facilitate this, they partnered up with multi-signature wallet provider BitGo to create a unique wallet where each user would have a segregated balance. So then, with the futures contracts and stuff, they could physically deliver the proceeds to that account that was, in some respects, controlled by the user. In August of 2016, a massive amount of Bitcoin was drained from those wallets in what is still one of the largest Bitcoin hacks to ever occur. At the time, I think the Bitcoins were valued around 70 million and now are valued at 4.5 billion or whatever absurd number it is now. And that occurred. And now the Department of Justice believes they've arrested the two individuals who were trying to launder the proceeds from that hack.
What they don't specifically say in this press release is that these two people were responsible for the hack. They say that they were trying to launder the funds, and they show how they were moving funds through all of these accounts and where to, but they never specifically state that it was these two who were responsible for it.
That's true. I still think they're the most likely candidates.
Why wouldn't they state that, though, I guess is my question.
Could be inadequate evidence at this point, could be worries about jurisdiction, could be that they think these charges are very clear with overwhelming evidence and they will not have issues getting the sentence for them. Yeah, so those are the reasons I think they could believe it to be them and not say it. And so part of the reason I think that they're the most likely candidates at this point is that when the feds decrypted the file with all the private keys and addresses in the cloud storage of Dutch, they found the private keys for the initial wallet that funds were withdrawn to right after the hack. And so they're in possession of the private keys that the hacker was sending the funds to. It is still theoretically possible that they could have been collaborating with someone else who transferred those private keys to them, or working with someone under some kind of agreement where the hacker, after gaining access, would transfer the funds to addresses they controlled. But I think the most likely explanation is that they were the ones responsible for it.
I think a lot of people find, including myself, find that quite hard to believe, because while, like you said, Heather Morgan talks a lot about social engineering, and it doesn't seem like there's too much available about this Ilya Liechtenstein guy, but she does talk about social engineering. She does talk about these weird things that mostly con men and criminals would be into. So I understood, but also let's see if I can find some clips and play them for our audience of the kind of garbage that she was putting out into the world for the past several years. And really, the cringiest, most, whatever, here you go. Give it a listen.
I started my company when I was 23 and grew it into a multi-million dollar business with zero outside funding. I had no connections, I didn't go to an Ivy League school, and I wasn't trust fund.
Russell Conklin named that hot grandma. You really wanna bang. Always run the guilt game ever since I was 15. I'm many things. A rapper, an economist, a journalist, a writer, a CEO, and a dirty, 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 dirty hoe.
Awkward as fuck.
I'm not here to defend the musical career of Razzle Khan, but like, even in her song, she talks about like spearfishing, the technique of like finding a targeted individual and using information about them to try to gain access to resources, systems, whatever. And that, to me, is consistent with what we know about the Bitfinex hack and how it occurred.
What would be your best guess then about what transpired? Do you think that Heather Morgan pretended to be a Bitfinex employee, and or Ilya pretended to be a Bitfinex employee, and these two got the stuff they needed and spoke to BitGo and got the multi-sig approved? Is that what you think is going on here?
So there have been a few different theories about how this occurred. So because Bitfinex was trying this new thing with the segregated user wallets, their implementation of BitGo was somewhat unique. And for each of these multi-signature addresses, they were set up so that they required 2 out of 3 to sign. So either Bitfinex in BitGo, user in Bitfinex, or user in BitGo in order to withdraw. There were also limitations, withdrawal limits, set up for the wallet as a whole that were established on the BitGo side of the API. The parts we know for certain, and like what Phil Potter described to David Gerard when Gerard was writing Attack of the 50-Foot Blockchain, is that the hacker got into Bitfinex's system, got access to the API key that allowed them to change the withdrawal limits, and then used that or a separate key to then withdraw the funds. And so what I think is the most likely methodology is that Bitfinex was using a single API key that had permissions to both change the withdrawal limit and sign for the withdrawal. I don't know exactly how Dutch or Heather would have gotten access, but I think it is plausible, especially knowing their familiarity with phishing and spear phishing and techniques like that, that they could have targeted different Bitfinex executives with the goal of gaining this information. One interesting piece of information that came out recently is that we learned that Paolo Arduino, the current CTO of Bitfinex and Tether, became the CTO of Bitfinex and Tether on that day when the hack occurred. And so it suggests to me that there was a dereliction at some point that resulted in this hack. I think the other important thing here, Bitstamp was hacked in 2015, and their hack was very similarly executed. Executives were targeted with emails that had information about their particular interests and the groups and stuff they participated in, with a Word document attached that had a macro that used an exploit to gain access to the system at a higher level. And so it is, we know for a fact that other exchanges around this same era were compromised by this style of spear phishing attack.
Okay, so that gets us to now. We don't exactly know how they managed to recover these funds. We do know that they decrypted a wallet, which is fascinating. I don't know how they did that, which granted was connected to the cloud. These people were doing a lot of dumb things that people who were really diehard kind of OPSEC people would never do. But it does make you wonder, how did the government acquire these funds if it wasn't just a what we call a wrench attack, where they basically said, like, either you give us this thing or we're going to beat the living crap out of you. So there's that question. I think also the other question is that the funds are not fully recovered. They've only recovered 3/4 of the funds or so. So let's talk about that.
Sure. I mean, I've got a theory on how they decrypted it. I think it is unlikely the decryption itself was broken. And so if it was encrypted outside of the normal encryption of the cloud provider, my guess is they found the password written somewhere when they executed the search warrant for the house and found like the bag full of burner phones and the fake IDs and all that stuff. My guess is they also found some document that contained the password and then were able to gain access to the wallet. And yeah, I think that, well, I mean, maybe they've been able to sell off a portion of it through OTC desks that weren't picked up by like the exchanges and stuff we know the government was tracking for this or something like that. I think it's really too early for us to speculate where the remaining funds are at this point.
Well, they also used Monero and that didn't seem to help either, did it?
Well, the issue here is I think they used Monero after they moved the Bitcoin to AlphaGo or to AlphaBay, sorry. And so since the government got AlphaBay back in 2017 or 2018 and had access to the database and all the logs and information from there, they were then able to use that to help piece together the relationship between the Bitcoin coming into AlphaBay, the Monero coming out and being transferred to Virtual Currency Exchange 1, as it's described in the file, and then we're able to send a subpoena to that virtual currency exchange and tie it back to Ilya and Morgan.
So what you're saying is that despite all the claims of privacy and anonymity that run around almost all cryptocurrency, it's pretty easy to be compromised.
It is extraordinarily difficult to stay completely private on a public ledger where every transaction can be seen by anyone, especially if you are starting with a set of very hot coins that every exchange and competent law enforcement agency with a crypto division is tracking. Like, those wallets, those addresses, those coins have been flagged for years now, and every time they move, everyone knows. And so converting those into clean currency is not an easy task.
It feels like, oh, this is a good stopping point, but we're not even close yet, because what we need to also talk about is that Bitfinex and Tether have essentially utilized this hack and the other hack and all of the problems that they've had over these years to leverage debt. They've issued multiple coins, the RTT, Leo token, and the BFX token. So they've issued 3 coins because of all the problems that they've had. One of the interesting things that we've seen is that for the past few months, Leo token was going through the roof. So clearly somebody was aware that these motherfuckers were gonna get caught. We don't know who was aware, but somebody was. But let's talk about those coins. Let's talk about what they were doing, what it means for their future and what it means for the future of Bitfinex. Obviously, there's a lot of open-ended questions here that we can't answer, but let's just kind of touch on it.
Sure. So after Bitfinex was hacked for these millions of dollars in 2016, their solution was to do a bail-in, in which they gave most of their customers just over a 30% haircut of all their funds, replacing them with a BFX token, in which Bitfinex promised to repay in the future or allow you to convert to equity. It took them a bit of time to get the special purpose vehicles and stuff set up for people to begin the process of converting their BFX to equity, and to encourage people to go through with that conversion, they created a new token they called the Recovery Rights Token. So each BFX token represents $1 worth of Bitcoin, or $1 that was taken out of your account by Bitfinex when this hack occurred. The RRT token represented a claim on $1 of any recovered Bitcoins that were restored after the hack. So you could take $1 worth of BFX token, convert it to a dollar of Bitfinex equity, and get in exchange $1 worth of RRT, this token. Later, when Bitfinex was having issues due to the $1 billion worth of funds they gave without a contract to the alleged money launderers for the Colombian cartels, Crypto Capital Corp, they issued a new token called Leo and sold a billion of them to try to fill the hole in their books. This token entitles you to certain discounts if you're a trader on Bitfinex, and also if Bitfinex was ever able to recover the hacked Bitcoins after they paid back the RRT token holders, 80% of the remaining Bitcoin would be used to buy back and burn the Leo token.
So that's what we expect to see, I guess, is that we're going to see the essentially the end to the RRT token, and we are going to see, hopefully, sometime soon here, the kind of like a burn of the majority of Leo tokens because they can. But they can't yet because they don't have the Bitcoin in their possession yet, do they?
They do not. And this is the thing, is there's a legal process for this in which Bitfinex will need to submit a claim saying that they are the rightful owners of that Bitcoin, and assuming they can prove it through that process, they will gain access. I have seen some reporting recently that suggests that will not necessarily be an easy or smooth process for Bitfinex, but yes, if they are successful in doing that, there will no longer be any RRT tokens, and there will be way fewer Leo tokens, probably at a much higher valuation than they are currently.
Is there any reason to think that the government wouldn't give back these funds to Bitfinex?
So yeah, the reasons that Bitfinex would not get the funds back is if the U.S. government thought that the funds themselves were the proceeds of crime, or if they feel Bitfinex or Tether has unpaid taxes, fines, or anything else due to the U.S. government. I think it's quite plausible that Bitfinex does get these tokens back, these coins back at some point, but I would not necessarily expect it to be next week or even next month, and possibly not even next year.
I don't think there's any reason to suspect they won't ever get it back. I do think this is, at the end of the day, this is like a great thing for Bitfinex and Tether to have happen. And it does seem as though they did work with law enforcement on this. And honestly, like I have, about that, I have nothing bad to say. I think that all of that is good. And the more people that can be made whole from the bad things that have happened, I'm all about it. I don't want to see retail consumers get hurt by the stupidity of a large cryptocurrency exchange and a stablecoin provider. So all this makes me happy. I'm sure that people would think that we would be bitter and upset about it. But no, I'm quite happy. And I hope that it leads to, in general, I guess we know that it hasn't, but you hope that it would lead to better kind of OPSEC, better, and sorry for anyone that doesn't know, better operational security, better security in terms of like not wanting to get socially hacked and have all of these issues. To be fair, we don't know a lot about what exchanges are doing with security these days, and a lot of people who are in the know don't want to talk about it because then it'll compromise their security. So it'll be good. Maybe we can start to hear from some of these people about all of the things that they're doing to make sure that this never happens again.
Well, one of the things you touched on is really interesting there, that like a lot of these places won't talk about their security things and stuff like that. And Heather, one of the two arrested, used her role as a Forbes contributor to interview like the BitCo chief of compliance and like anti-money laundering and know your customer experts. And so used her role as this Forbes contributor to get access to these people to learn more about these topics, which is a fact I find fascinating.
I wish we knew more. It's unfortunate that the amounts we know are so minimal. I'm sure we're going to find out a lot more when the case goes to trial, ultimately, which I'm sure it will, unless they plead out, which is also very possible. I'm sure we're going to be doing a lot more updates about this story. I'd love to have a lawyer on and also have some operational securities experts on to kind of talk about all this stuff. So open invitation to anyone who would like to discuss those things with us. Is there anything else you want to add before we...
Yes. I think that your comment about the people who were hurt in the hack being made whole after all this time, and that potentially being a good thing, was striking to me because, like, the Bitcoins, the crypto that were removed from people's wallets, were replaced with this BFX token. And so because of that, they didn't have exposure to most of the increase in value of those cryptocurrencies over the intervening years. And like the, like we were saying, the amount hacked grew from 70 million to 4.5 billion. Then even the people who got their BFX tokens redeemed by Bitfinex, there was a bunch of oddity around that. You remember in March of 2018, they announced that they had redeemed all of the outstanding BFX tokens, and then a few days later filed a lawsuit against Wells Fargo saying that they had been wrongfully cut off from their correspondent banking access. So people who had had the BFX tokens in their wallet replaced with dollars in their Bitfinex accounts now could not withdraw those dollars because Bitfinex no longer had consistent banking relationships. And so I have always been curious about the timeline and knowledge of Bitfinex executives in those events. The other thing is, after the 2016 hack, Bitfinex promised they would get both a security audit and a full financial audit, which they would share with the community. Besides this, they also promised they would share their full methodology for calculating what the haircut amount was to prove that they weren't holding back corporate funds. None of these things were ever done, and Bitfinex still lacks that kind of transparency around these events that occurred. And I think now that there's a good chance they'll get the funds back, we have no hope of ever getting transparency around those things.
Yeah, and it's not just that, obviously. They don't fucking audit Tether. They don't audit anything. They don't do security audits. They don't inform anyone of what's going on. I also do think that part of this does look bad for executives, because anyone who's buying up Leo, it was not the US government buying a bunch of Leo tokens before they announced this. So
there is one mechanism by which it could be like an honest person who took a gamble and took a flyer, right? Because when the 2016 Bitfinex hack tokens started moving again at the end of January, they did the same thing that the US government has done in other seizures, which is send a small test transaction first and then send the rest in groups of 10,000. And someone noted this on the night it was occurring. And so someone could have taken a bet that it was the US government that was moving the coins, and that meant Leo might soon be more valuable.
To be fair, though, it's been on a pretty clean upward trajectory since February of last year. So this wasn't necessarily a new thing. You've seen a slow build from roughly $1.46 to now shooting all the way up to, at one point, $7.60. To me, it looks more as though people have been slowly buying up this token because they knew that something was going to happen. And seeing that huge pump after that was just the icing on the cake. Who knows, though? That's just total speculation. No, I have no proof. I'm not suggesting I do. I just want to point out that the chart looks really odd. Anyway, I think that's going to do it for this episode. Hopefully, we have an opportunity to talk about this again soon and bring you guys more up to date as it goes on. I know that we talk about Tether and Bitfinex regularly, so this is our bread and butter. So we will be talking about it again soon, and thank you for giving us a little bit of time to recap it for you.
If you liked this episode and want to support the show, please share it with a friend you think would be interested, or leave a rating or a review. These things seem small, but they really help us, and we truly appreciate all of your support. Thank you.